Okay, so Julia, at this point, the episode we're recording probably isn't going to come out for a few weeks, maybe even a month or two from the time we record it. So we need to make sure we do something timely and topical for the intro.
Okay, that does sound like a sage idea.
Thank you. So that said, can you believe what FIDE just did?
It's honestly shocking to the system.
They have outdone themselves.
I just can't even believe that this is hitting the internet at the exact day of the release of this episode.
Do you know how unbelievable this is?
How unbelievable is it?
We're making this joke months in advance about how we can't believe it, and yet here I am still not believing it.
Well, hopefully the people liked it.
Okay, well, I can't wait to find out what happened. Anyways, you're listening to a very special episode of Chess Feels. I'm Julia.
I'm also Julia.
And also, Julia, what are we doing here today?
Okay, so our idea for today's episode is that I have provided my esteemed co-host, JJ Lang, with a lot of pro bono clinical work. JJ has gotten assessments, emotional regulation support, even diagnostic evaluation on episode two. What am I getting out of this relationship, JJ?
What have you done for me lately? I mean, or what have I done for you lately, I guess.
That's my question. So I was thinking today we could turn the tables.
Okay, I only see one problem.
Okay, go on.
I don't have any skills, so how can I help?
Okay, no. Okay, so, just like you're coming in and we're trying to sort of figure out what's going on with you, with your chess, get a big picture.
And now that we've done that and solved it.
Now that we've solved you, I thought it could be not only enjoyable, but extraordinarily useful and informative for our listeners, for you to tell everybody what's wrong with me and also help.
And for those wondering my credentials, my best friend is a clinical psychologist.
Oh yeah, should I have like given more of that, JJ?
Oh, no. I was going to say my credentials for being able to help you is that you're a psychologist, so I've probably learned some stuff from you, was the joke.
Okay.
It didn't work, and that's okay.
Okay, but maybe like actually explain it just so people don't feel confused.
Okay. So I love this idea because long term, a dream I have for this pod is a dream in which Julia is done with schooling, with postdocs, where Julia's going to have so much time on her hands. She's going to be playing so much more chess. And we're really going to be diving into what that looks like and what struggles she's coming across in her own chess, if there's any. Probably there won't be any, but if there's any. And I think that'll just be a fun opportunity for listeners because I'm not very good at chess, but I'm probably significantly better than most of our listeners. And Julia is also not very good at chess and might be more relatable to some of our listeners.
Come on, guys. I want to be the fan favorite. I know I'm not the best, but I'm the most relatable.
Exactly. You are the fan favorite. This is so obvious. Text Julia to 1-800-CHESS-FEELS if she's the fan favorite.
Right. So right now, I am certainly not at a point in my life or my career where I can be dedicating a ton of study and over the board practice to increase my skill and my rating. But I like how you put it, JJ. I think that life is long and the future for me is bright and shining. So why don't we just start today by bringing me down a peg and you can tell
Yes.
me everything that's wrong with me
Can't wait.
and what I should be doing to fix those gaping, bleeding wounds.
I cannot wait to start patching you up. I think this is a great idea. And I want to say also, I think it's a great idea because something else that is relatable about you that makes you the fan favorite is I imagine the average adult amateur chess player is much closer to you in terms of being busy and not having a whole lot of time to dedicate to chess, to tournaments, to over the board than they are
Totally.
to the prototypical hashtag adult improver who seems to find these magical 20 hours a week and travel to tournaments multiple times, maybe even a month. That person is definitely the exception, not the rule. And a lot of chess improvement content is directed towards, if not somebody who has that much time, somebody who aspires to have that much time, in a way that I think, frankly, is just sexist, because I imagine most of those people who at least have families are just the men who find it easier to carve out or just take or claim that time.
I mean, truly, it's hard to imagine that there's not a gendered component there who has the ability to really improve at chess. It is not a small effort. Either that becomes part of your career, or you are really finding the time outside of that. So yeah, absolutely. The other thing I'm also excited about for this part, JJ, is it'll be kind of cool for me to maybe get an inside view as to how you might start this process with a new student. And maybe people will be excited to see what that looks like too. How do you even figure out where someone should be directing their attention when they're coming to you and saying, okay, I'm ready to revamp my chess. I'm ready to tend to the wounds. How do we even start to explore what those priorities, what the biggest problems really are?
Yeah, I'm excited too, because everyone's different, but I'm sure this will be a useful conversation for many. And I'm glad that we're having this conversation now, where we're not even at the, okay, I'm ready, I've carved out the time, I'm starting to carve out the time stage, but I still like chess. I still like playing chess. Also, I don't have very much time right now. And I think having a conversation centered on that and what we can do or try to do in those moments is useful, and something that's often overlooked in discussions that assume either you have the time or can carve out the time.
Hell yeah. And yeah, everybody's different, but everyone listening to this podcast has one thing in common, which is they want to be more like me. So let's dive in.
Everybody's different, but we love you anyways. Okay. So sometimes this can start with you telling me the problems you're having, or sometimes you can come in saying nothing other than, I'm sure I have problems and I'm not sure what they are, and I can start asking questions. So I'm not sure what you'd prefer.
Yeah, I know. That's what I think is so interesting, because I think that therapy, this actually works very similarly. Sometimes people come in and they have a long history of therapy, or they at least have a lot of language and understanding and self-awareness to really kind of say, hey, here's what's going on and here is the problem, especially if they have that vernacular and they can sort of describe mm-hmm. it to the set of symptoms. But sometimes people come in and they just know, I am in distress. My life is in shambles. I wake up and I do not feel good every day. So part of it too can be helping provide them the language, provide them the understanding. So sometimes that's kind of coming from me as the clinician or the evaluator. And that in and of itself is a huge benefit to someone who just thinks they're coming in for an assessment. So in therapy, we kind of talk about assessment as treatment. Conceptualization mm-hmm. is helpful in and of itself. We improve what we measure. We understand ourselves. We reduce things like self-criticism and stigma. So I will be curious, JJ, to see how you and I can maybe meet each other. Like, what can I bring to the table to sort of try to explain to you where my gaps are? But then how can you maybe also widen those gaps and help me know that my problems are actually much worse and much more embarrassing than I ever
could have imagined? Exactly. Yeah, the only thing you described is different is we're going to try to increase the self-criticism, but otherwise, this is exactly the same kind of project.
He's joking, you guys. If anyone wants to take lessons with JJ, that was a joke.
Oh, I'm serious. I'm probably going to tell you that any sort of game annotation where you're able to highlight recurring errors, even if they're on Blitz and Rapid, and even if they're incredibly sparse, would probably help your chess more than anything else. And that little self-criticism would go a long way. So I was dead serious, but okay.
I was trying to help you out. But all right, where do we begin? You, the today's foremost expert.
So talk to me about what your relationship to chess is like, how much you're playing, thinking about chess, doing anything chess related. Please be honest.
Oh, God. Why do we have to start here? Okay, you don't mess around. Let's dive in. Okay, it's not good. I'm smiling because I can't even try to gloss this over and make it look good to save face on the podcast, because unfortunately, JJ and I are also dear friends. So JJ knows what the damage looks like. So let me actually really try to think about how to concisely summarize. And this is useful for myself too. I play chess every day. I play bullet every day. I play blitz most days. I'll go up to 3-2. I'll go up to 5-0. I'll go up to 5-3 if I'm feeling super spicy. Before the winter break, I had a period of time where I just was feeling more into it. And the first step I made was I just slowed down. I started playing rapids and I noticed that my enjoyment of chess went way, way up. But it's hard to tell direction of causality. I really think there's something to be said that I had a little bit more space and my mood was high and my energy was higher. Overall, the spark was just there. So then I started playing more rapid, but they kind of seemed to feed off themselves. I was really trying to also analyze the games after. I even went so far as to, on a couple of occasions, opening YouTube. I was like watching a few more chess videos again. I think I was even watching some of JB. I watched a little bit of Danya that I hadn't seen in a while. I was really trying to just be watching good people play chess and explain themselves and just sort of let it wash over me. That was like the extent to how I was soaking it up. And all my ratings went up.
I believe that.
The other big thing I did at that time was I took myself off of Zen mode. I know that Chris Callahan kind of talked about how taking away those ratings like on Lee Chess, if you hide them, can really help. It does not help me. It does not help my rating even a little bit.
Same.
I think and I can talk more about like why I feel like that is for me, but no, that is a big problem. And so overall, I felt like things were going well. And then over my winter break, I didn't really get much of a break as a healthcare worker, and my stress just went way, way up. And I never hit my stride again. I had a week where I was totally underwater. And since then, I have been back to the pain and the suffering where all I do is play Blitz and Bullet. I'm distracted. I'm not carving out the time. So if something or someone interrupts me, I just get really irritated. I find myself making really stupid mistakes. The only saving grace I think I can point to is that I really have started trying to do tactics again. So, okay, if I'm not in a space where I'm really focused on chess, instead of trying to play a blitz where my attention is going to go elsewhere, I've been trying to switch and just have tactics on in the background because I can kind of go in and out of it. And it just feels like a different way to force myself to slow down and think about chess.
That was going to be my first suggestion.
Oh, yay. Okay. So I had a good instinct there.
Yes.
Fortunately, I sometimes do tactics during, you know, meetings. Not work meetings. I would never do that.
Are the tactics in the room with us right now?
And I actually really tanked my tactics ratings as well because I really didn't care. You know, it's incredible. A lot of people, JJ, and I'm going to be curious just to hear you respond to this. I know I've given you a lot already, but something that I feel like is different about me, I'm not like the other girls, is I could imagine, and you can correct me, that a lot of your students come in and they just care so much and they want to get better, but they're not succeeding or their rating, you know, goes up and down and it impacts sort of their motivation or their enjoyment. Mm-hmm. I think I have the opposite problem where I so genuinely, deep down in my heart and soul, deep down in my bones, don't care at all. And I think it hurts me. I think there must be an optimal dose here.
What don't you care about? The rating or what?
I don't care about mm-hmm. about the ratings. When the ratings start going down, nothing much happens inside of me. And I just have noticed at times where I do take it more seriously. And I even think to myself, okay, I'm going to like get my ratings back up to what I know is more of a norm. Mm-hmm. That requires me to like pay attention and just take it even slightly seriously. I'm talking about the bare minimum here. Like, just don't be doing it with the TV also on and mm-hmm. on the phone with my cousin. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And then when I see the numbers go up, I feel like I get some positive momentum. Like, oh yeah, of course I can do this. I'm enjoying mm-hmm. this. Okay, I care a little bit. And it actually keeps me coming back. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, how do I sort of keep that positive momentum? How do I keep myself in that state of almost the inertia where it can build and I can get some momentum and have a routine? And also for someone who doesn't have a ton of time, what are the things I can bring in to help myself treat chess that way? So I know I gave you a lot of information.
No, that's perfect.
And then one thing I just also want to add is the Blitz and the Bullet gives me such bad habits and I know mm-hmm. it. I can feel it. So the puzzles have been nice to counteract that because sometimes I do the bad habit and I immediately lose. And then if I pause for even 2 seconds, I can see, oh, it was that mate sequence, but think about move order, look at the whole board, consider counterattacks, consider checks on both sides. So that has been helpful, but I know the bad habits are running a lot deeper than they were 2 years ago, and I'm ashamed of myself.
Cool. Okay. No, so this is awesome. So I have so many things I want to respond to, some specific suggestions, but the first thing I want to encourage you to do is find ways to shake off some of that shame. or guilt, because you almost have this meta guilt where it's not, oh, my ratings are going down and it makes me feel bad, but it's more when my ratings go down and I don't feel bad, that makes me feel bad, or I worry that I should feel bad, or
no, unfortunately, it's just none of the above. Even when I said I'm ashamed of myself, I'm smiling. I'm not ashamed of myself. Maybe the move I'm doing, JJ, is even my ratings are going down. I know my skill is going down. I know my habits are going down. And I don't feel bad about that.
Yeah.
But there's a deep part of me that really wants to be good at chess and doesn't want to have those habits. So maybe the move I'm doing is, oh, if I was ashamed of myself, at least I would be working harder. It's not that I don't feel bad about myself, even about not feeling bad about myself. Unfortunately, I want to be really honest.
No. Okay. No, no. This is really helpful because I think I understand now. Because what I was really going to say is whatever sort of shame you were feeling at whatever level doesn't seem like it's giving you the sort of motivation you want it to. And what I'm hearing you say is, I haven't found what is giving me that motivation. And I'm thinking maybe if there is some shame, that would be the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if shame is the best motivator here. It's almost certainly not. So you might actually be starting at an advantageous point to not be starting with, oh, I feel this shame because I know I'm better than this, or should be better than this, or should have a higher rating than this. And the first thing I wanted to talk about was what those sorts of motivators could be. And then we can use that to talk about the kinds of habits we can build up even with not very much time.
Yeah, I love that. Everything you said makes perfect sense to me. Yes, I do think I'm in a good starting place because I'm not carrying around a lot of self-loathing. So I do think that's good, because when these things happen, and even when my rating dips, I don't feel like, oh, I'm going to quit. That's it. I hate this game. Right. I think, yep, that's how it goes. See you there tomorrow.
Exactly. Very similar relationship that I have with those ratings, especially online ratings, by the way. When my ratings are a solid 100, 200 points lower than they have been, I don't feel bad at all. I struggle sometimes to get out of the gutter, but I don't feel like it impacts me very much at all. But then once they start rising, I get that positive momentum going. A difference between us, which we talked about on the addiction episode, is that I am far more likely to go on massive benders and chase those rating highs once I start getting that positive feedback in a way that is not part of your personality. But I wanted to focus this time on the similarity, which is we are not discouraged or upset or embarrassed or ashamed by the negatives. But once some positives start rolling in, it's pleasant.
Yeah, it's pleasant. Yeah. So that just kind of does seem good to me. I'm glad you pointed that out for sure. So I would be kind of interested to explore this in two ways. One, like what could be motivating? Because I don't really know the answer to that. But then also, are there things I can do even when my motivation is low? Because sometimes in therapy, we talk about the difference between motivation and willingness. So for example, for people who are experiencing something like depression, one of the symptoms of depression is this thing called anhedonia, and it's low motivation. And that absolutely will feed into even the things that we recommend to help people alleviate depression. So I guess when I'm sort of thinking about these dynamics, I'm also very conscious of the idea that sometimes we really want something and our motivation is low. We really value it and it's important, but we don't feel this excitement and enthusiasm. I really want to be the kind of person who can find ways to some extent to do it anyway.
And I've seen people unironically say things like, I'm feeling depressed. What can I do to feel better? Please don't suggest going outside or exercising.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And maybe like the chess equivalent of that is, I really want to improve at chess and I'm struggling to find motivation. What should I do? Please don't tell me to go over my games.
Yeah, yeah. Please don't tell me to hit analyze.
Yeah, so this is a great starting point, because this is where I was going to suggest some sort of tactics as the first thing. And maybe the value for some of the more gamified tactics like Puzzle Streak and Storm on Lee Chess, or Puzzle Rush and Puzzle Battle on chess.com, is because they're gamified, and even the ones that have the time and speed elements, are they're going to be pretty concise. They feel pretty easy to do, even when the motivation for the deep work, or even the motivation to try to spend 3 to 10 minutes on a puzzle, might not be there. I think spending 3 to 5 minutes on a puzzle rush or playing a survival knowing that it's probably not going to be your all-time best. It's
I'm not going to hit 63 on my first try.
That was not my first try.
You guys, it was the first time JJ had ever opened puzzles on the chess.com app. 63.
I did see, I think it was on Reddit, a screenshot of someone's profile, and it was like games played 10,580, puzzle solved 0. And it was just, hilarious. I want to be this guy.
Didn't you and Akash once do it together and get to 69?
We got to 69. It took about 3 hours on stream. There were several other people on the stream with us doing it. And then there were other people like Strong Todd who were in the chat. And so it was a real team effort to get to 69.
Okay. So you can't claim it as your own. But 63 is nothing to sneeze at.
Not at all. But the point, circling back to you, and I'm watching you deflect with flattery and it works.
Didn't you do a puzzle once?
63, actually.
In a row. Okay, go on.
Is those are things you can do that might require very much motivation. And I could see them inspiring motivation in two ways. One is if you're fucking up and getting things wrong on these streaks as they get progressively harder at pretty early stages, or they're the sort of bonehead mistakes that you're making in your blitz and bullet games when you're distracted and you're making them on the rush. Well, first of all, you just start a new one and there's not a record of it the way that there is losing a game. It doesn't affect your rating. It doesn't affect who you're playing in the future. It doesn't affect any of those stats. But it also can give you this way to kind of get a clearer snapshot of where your head is mentally. And that can just be useful to say, oh, okay, I did some puzzles and I was, you know, missing mate in ones, missing that piece was hanging. Can go in a couple directions from there.
Okay, one I hope is, I'm not missing mate in ones and hanging pieces. Okay.
Oh, I do that sometimes. I mean, I don't know. If I'm like super distracted and frazzled, and some of them are kind of tricky, right?
In blitz,
like,
I do. In blitz, yeah, and bullet, no, I do for sure.
That's what I mean. Is like if I'm doing like a 5-minute puzzle rush and like we get to like the teens or 20s or something, and I put my, there's two moves that look like mate, and I pick the one where the queen's actually hanging. Totally something I'll do, especially if I'm distracted and it's a timed puzzle rush. And if I'm doing that, then one thing that could come out of that is it tells me, you know what? Any even unmotivated desire I had to play Blitz or Bullet is actually gone. If I'm missing shit like this right now, I actually don't want to. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing to, I view it almost like the chess equivalent of a breathalyzer. Like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be driving right now. And
I really like that. Wait, JJ, that feels like gold, actually. Before anyone is allowed to play Blitz or Bullet, you should have to do a 3-minute puzzle rush. You have to do the 3 minutes for Bullet. You have to do 5 minutes if you're going to play Blitz. And then we have to have some thresholds. Like, if you're losing before you hit 10, you may not buckle your seatbelt and turn on the ignition.
I mean, I think that would be a cool tool to see somebody develop within Lee Chess. But it's definitely something that I try to
force you to do.
Where I've learned that when I'm super distracted or frazzled or for whatever reason, just playing well below my usual skill level, I get less enjoyment out of it in a way that makes me less excited to seek out more chess, less excited to go over those games. And that's something too, is when I'm playing shit chess, it's really difficult for me to even click through and look through the first 10 moves and see if there's anything in the opening that I could learn from or any moment in that game that could provide any nugget of useful information, because I just don't want to look at that game because I know how poorly it ended.
Sure.
I think it is valuable to have the idea of, you know, before I start playing any time control, I'm going to do a few puzzles, a puzzle rush or something. And if the scores are low, if the mistakes I'm making are massive, then I probably shouldn't play. Maybe I can keep doing these and maybe talk about set shifting. Maybe after 30 minutes of doing a 5-minute puzzle rush 5 or 6 times in the background, you're just kind of bringing some of your muscle memory back almost, and you're getting closer to your usual skill level. And all you've really done is idly solved mostly back rank mate puzzles for a half hour. Totally.
But I can see how it's additive, because
exactly.
Then it's like you shift into the mode before you play.
Exactly.
Now you're going to play better. Now you're rating. Why not like do that dip it does when you for the first 10 minutes, and then you'll enjoy it and you'll keep playing. And I see the snowball upward.
Exactly. And I don't give a shit about the rating dip as much as As much as, if you're not making the kinds of egregious, distracted mistakes, then maybe you'll be more willing to look at the game or more willing to keep the game in a study and go back to it later. Not because we're doing a deep, serious analysis of our blitz games, but because if you're learning an opening or trying to get better at certain openings, every game you play is going to give you some amount of data. And being able to see what did or didn't go well in the early stage, or what kinds of mistakes you make later in the game, or positions that can just be fun to think about on their own, right? Even if there's no way you're going to think about them very well in a 3-minute game or a 10-minute game, it can still be fun to go back with more time and say, how would I want to play this position?
Cool. I like that.
So things like puzzles and gamified puzzles, I think, are useful both in the sense of they give you a good snapshot of where your head is right now. And you can decide from there whether that means you're actually just going to put the phone down and not do that, or whether you want to just keep doing that and see if things get better and you get more wrapped up in it, then maybe you start playing some more chess and it snowballs. That can be a good way to go. I also like that because when it comes to the serious puzzles, the hard puzzles, the rated puzzles, I have a lot of gripes with online puzzle generators.
Okay,
and I'm
one.
Not sure how useful they are in training, especially for people who are short on time and especially people who are short on motivation.
Okay.
I don't even know where to start. I think I'll start with motivation. A lot of these puzzles have whatever puzzle rating they have because of a formula that determines what the difficulty level of the puzzle is based on how long it takes people of what different rating levels to solve them.
Okay, that's actually even more intricate than I would have guessed. I would have thought it's, I don't know, what's the rating level of people who get it wrong or right. But if it's even looking at how long does it take, that's interesting to me.
I'd at least assume it's looking at time. I could be wrong there. But a downside to that is there are all sorts of confounding variables that will make it not a very useful judge of how difficult the puzzle is actually, and leads to a lot of puzzles being not particularly useful. So some of the issues are puzzles that have relatively long solutions, but pretty obvious first and second moves that are forcing. There's going to be a number of people solving puzzles who will think for 30 seconds or 10 seconds and say, well, it has to be this one check and play it. And then you end up with rather difficult puzzles that go several moves deep. But because most people are getting the first move or the first three moves correct quickly, it represents that puzzle as being easier than it actually is.
Oh, okay. I see.
You'll also have a lot of puzzles such as Maiden ones that are rated 2200 difficulty because you have people who are speeding their way through the puzzles and they see the hanging rook and take it before they see there was Maiden one and they spent 1.8 seconds on the puzzle. But there are 2200 in puzzles and they got it wrong. So this must be a really hard puzzle. And no, right. It's just a speedster who missed it.
I'm not sure though how much that mismatch is getting in my way, JJ. Okay, like if I'm being really honest, that definitely is not something that is deterring me or discouraging me from doing them.
Now on to the ones that I think might be more relevant to you.
Okay.
Most of these puzzles are determined at least partially algorithmically by there being a massive drop between the computer evaluation before a move was played to after a move is played in a game. What that means is sometimes you'll get incredibly thematic, clear exercises. And even if you get it wrong, it's clear what you should have been looking for and what should have been relevant.
Right. That's kind of what even determines what kind of position functions as a puzzle.
One would hope. But relatively often, what you actually end up with is a position where, for all sorts of reasons, one move is better than the others. And it might be really difficult to articulate what the theme is. And even if there is a useful evaluative exercise in those positions, you're going to get a grand total of zero natural language words explaining what's going on there. And those kinds of puzzles where there's no feedback, there's no conversation with anyone about that, can be very discouraging because feels like you're just getting things right or wrong randomly. So you might as well either guess your way through the next one or not even bother trying to understand it.
Right. That is
another issue with the algorithmic puzzles. And I wanted to say that even if that doesn't discourage you, it can have the issue of just not being helpful, even if you're doing it, or not being really as helpful.
No, that I really follow. That definitely strikes a chord. But then immediately my brain just goes to, then what is a way of doing tactics that provides that? besides, I don't know, sitting down with the chess coach or for someone in my shoes who only has so much to give, it doesn't feel like that is something that is packaged. There really is such an advantage to just hopping on chess.com, it's the app, and doing the puzzles because of that kind of mode of delivery. And so it does feel like you can get more of the nuance and the understanding with a coach or in a book, but it doesn't lend itself quite the same way. Are there other things that you know of JJ that might kind of strike a balance between those two things?
Yes.
Beautiful.
Okay. So first question is, what's so bad about a book? What's so bad about pulling out a book of puzzles that at least are going to have answers in the back with explanations and opening it up to a page and having that book in your lap? Or even what I like to do is, if I have a digital copy of a book, I like to print out 1 to 2 pages at a time of maybe there'll be 6 or 9 exercises on the page. And I'll just sit with that sheet of paper. And then I can always go back and check the answers later. What's so unwieldy about any of those methods?
I think at the end of the day, it just would need the right book. I think I've tried to do it that way. And I end up with something that might be, for example, way above my level. So it's hard for me to even follow these positions or to even know where to start. And so then I sort of disengage and get lost. Because if that happens to me on chess.com app, I click the wrong answer, I take the best stab at it after 5 or 10 minutes and I get it wrong and I keep moving. There's something that feels hard for me when I don't have a resource that feels like a good fit or feels like I can roll through. So part of it might be I'm not engaging with the right materials for my strength.
Yeah, that's a really good bit of insight. And there's definitely trial and error there. And maybe erring on the side of something that might be quote unquote too easy and working up from there will behoove you more than starting with, you know, something that looks interesting but might turn out to be rather difficult.
Yeah, I really think there's something to that. I feel like we should pause on that because we talk about that in therapy too. And I kind of want to extend this parallel with something like a depressive disorder because I do think it's useful where there might be sort of a similar lack of motivation or there might be some of that black and white thinking like, oh, I can't do what I normally do or what I want to do in my daily life, the type of exercise or the type of socializing. And right now I'm not doing anything, but there's going to be such a beautiful, rich, vast gray area in between that black and white.
Yeah.
So really similarly, when we are doing that type of intervention for something like depression, you might hear it called, for example, behavioral activation. How do we start to add things back in? And we talk about this exact idea. Mm-hmm. We want to start with things that actually feel so easy that you couldn't possibly not do them because we're trying to get momentum. We're trying to get you engaged. We're trying to build that muscle of engaging with this type of exercise, of getting in the habit of it in the process itself. So we're not worried about, do the hardest thing you can possibly do. Let's find that line. It's exactly the opposite. Let's do something where you're guaranteed to get a little bit of quick reward. Okay. And get that ball rolling. There's so much utility in that.
Yeah. So finding a good book that would be recommended online for players who are maybe your rating minus 400 or something.
I love
it. Or 600 could be a place to start. Susan Polgar's Chess Tactics for Champions is an excellent book. Puzzles by theme, explanations in the back. They get rather tricky towards the end. Oh. They start pretty straightforward, but that's something I recommend as maybe a challenge book for players rated in like the 800 to 1200 US chess range. And the thought of you knocking out 5 or 10 of those in a sitting as you're just sitting somewhat distracted, but are able to look at those positions, that strikes me as pretty manageable.
Yeah. And I feel like something that even occurred to me that could be helpful is I could have a book like that just sitting on my desk. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when it's an opportunity for me to engage with chess, it's literally in between my own therapy patients and I have 8 minutes. So it's not nothing, but it's not this big, juicy chunk of time. But if I had a book already out, already open to the page where I was working on it, I feel like it really wouldn't be that hard to glance over and like slowly work my way through something like that. That does sound kind of enjoyable.
Yeah. And something that I would recommend on the book side of things is if you have a little notebook or journal, or when I print out pages of a book, I might even write on the page where you try and write down your answers. The super disciplined overachiever way to do this would be you write down your full answers. You try to anticipate all of the candidate moves. You write out your lines to the end. That's not what we're doing here.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head.
Yeah.
JJ's talking. I can't even control myself. My brain is like, yeah, no, that's not what we're doing here.
But what could be really useful, even if we're not doing all that, is a rough sort of scorekeeping. But I'm actually more interested in when you don't get something right, what did you miss? And a quick jot down of what that is can be really useful. I can see it being activating for the next time you get that 8-minute break to at least have in your head the last time that you were even distractedly looking at this puzzle. You really thought you nailed it, but weren't looking to see what mating threats your opponent had. So now right. You just have a new extra thing to look for before you go and look at the answer.
Cool.
Or if you end up with a little journal that whenever I do this, it's consistently going to be, I might vaguely clock that there's a weakness in my position. And So sometimes my journal will just be like, didn't make this connection, or even worse, didn't even look for my weaknesses, didn't ask if they have checks. And yeah. I think that having a page littered with that note over and over again is an incredibly helpful reminder for when you feel like doing the hard work of sitting down for a puzzle for 10 or 20 minutes and actually going through it and challenging yourself, and you actually have the energy and you're invested in that, or you're getting to play that slow game of chess for the first time in weeks. You have this reminder of, here's what you've been struggling with lately. Not to feel bad because you haven't been focusing 100%. You're obviously going to make mistakes. But when you aren't 100%, when you aren't playing the best chess of your life, when you aren't thinking the clearest you've ever thought, you now know what sorts of errors you're making and can take a concerted effort to double check that you're not making those errors here and now. And that's just a really useful way to get more out of that study time or that training game time, practice time, because you already have this cheat sheet of, here's what you've been struggling with recently.
Yeah, 1000%. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, I can imagine someone thinking about that in training for almost anything. Like, you want to stay a little sharp. It doesn't mean you're training for the Olympics during the off season, but can you just kind of keep building muscles and slow the decline for me, I guess.
And I'm somebody who doesn't respond well to positive motivation. It doesn't do anything for me. And so seeing the list of mistakes motivates me to not make the mistakes, or to try harder to not make the mistakes. But I could see a version of this working either instead of or in addition with the things that you do right. Let's say that you've been forgetting to look for your opponent's checks when you're solving tactics. Every time you are pretty confident you found something, but then you realize that your opponent has a check and that that's not the solution because of that check. Write that down. When you almost fall into the trap, but then realize that you were about to make that mistake and don't. And you're like, wait, no, this isn't it, because there's a check and I saw it. When you do that.
Uh-huh.
Then if you're this kind of person, write that down, that you caught yourself, that you didn't fall for it.
I think we need to zoom out, because I think you're speaking to something that feels valuable, which is start tracking even a little bit. Just start keeping track of what I'm doing and where my attention should be. I kind of like this idea, because to me, it feels like what I'm trying to do right now isn't even necessarily fill in all the holes. It's like the work is the exploration. It is the deep dive of even paying attention to where the holes are. And I already said it today, but I'm going to say it again, because we know that this is empirically true. We improve what we measure. I can imagine there's a lot of utility in the tracking. One, because it helps guide our attention to where it needs to be. And we might even see sort of a little bit of improvement there with those silly mistakes. Then also, it feels like there's something, JJ, that you're speaking to that might be maybe motivating, but to at least increase the regularity of the routine, to at least bring somebody back in terms of the tracking itself. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you set the goal not of, I'm going to do 25 puzzles a day, or I'm going to do 25 minutes of puzzles a day, but just as the goal of, I'm going to track what I do, then I think it becomes easy to organically bottom up figure out what sorts of goals you might want to set for yourself out of that. Or you might say, okay, the thought of studying chess feels awful, or I feel so tired, I can't really imagine studying chess, where maybe studying chess is this big cloud in your head of setting up the board, going through the annotated games, etc. But then you see the book on your desk, or you see the little notebook that mentions, like, okay, yesterday I solved 8 puzzles, or or spent 10 minutes and you're like, well, I could spend 10 minutes. All right, that wasn't so bad. I could try to do another one. So I think there's something that is motivating about not trying to chase these goals, but just knowing that anything you do gets to be tracked, and anything that's tracked is something that's there and is a proof that you were doing something.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'll see if it lands for me.
But I was going to say that I appreciate it as well, your zoom out, because two things. First of all, I wanted to make the point that what you're tracking doesn't have to be negative. If the thought of writing down every single thing that you do wrong or goes wrong is demoralizing, that I don't want you to throw out the whole idea of tracking what you do because you don't want to just have a list staring at you of everything you do wrong. The other thing I wanted to say is when I hear people talk about tracking, I do sometimes see it conflated into this trend of hitting goals that are numerical of I'm going to do this many puzzles, I'm going to spend this much time, and I'm tracking and I'm making sure I'm spending 30% of my time on this versus that. And the sorts of very rigid kind of things that for somebody who doesn't have a lot of time or motivation, I imagine is incredibly off-putting. So I was trying to demonstrate the ways we could track how we chess without it becoming a bunch of charts and goals and percentages and things that could feel like exactly what we don't want to do.
Right. Interesting.
And the other thing I wanted to add to circle back to that I thought was really valuable in what you're saying, Julia, is the idea that the tracking is the work. Because imagine if one day you wake up and you're like, okay, magically I have time, I have energy, I really want to study chess. I really want to put some work into it. Or a year from now, okay, it's time, I actually have more time in my life. Where do I start? And all you have is, well, I want to chess better. Then there's so much to do in that moment where you have the momentum or you have the energy or excitement to even figure out where you're going to start. And a lot of that figuring out where to start is kind of demoralizing. Like if you start with the tactics book and it's the wrong level, you start by studying some games and the writing just isn't clicking for you or something. So what if instead, between now and a year from now, what we've tracked includes things like, of all the garbage blitz games we've played, just like jotting down some, got caught up in the opening, didn't know this variation, don't know what, like even if got hit with an alapin, didn't have a good response to it.
For me, the thing that I find myself wishing I was tracking isn't like, oh, got caught up in an alapin and lost. It'd be more like reminder to self, like look up this variation in the alapin. Yeah. I know that's what you're saying.
Yes.
But for me, there's something about when I'm tracking and it feels directive, like it feels like a step, like a thing to do. I find that that really increases the likelihood that I'll see that list in the future and actually do the thing that I want to do based off the list.
Oh, that's so interesting. Sorry, I'm really glad you said that because this is potentially a difference between us. I have to trick myself. If I know there's a list, if I know there's directives, then that just kind of gets rolled up into the black cloud I'm trying to avoid of things that feel more like the shoulds that feel like the hard work or the things I don't want to do.
Yeah. And maybe that's because I don't feel any shoulds. Like I'm not a professional chess player.
Right.
I'm not even a streamer. I'm not a coach. If anything, I'm swimming upstream here. So for me, that just feels helpful because it's almost like my brain needs to mentally do that step. So if I am going to look at a list of everything I got wrong or like areas that I would want to study, it's almost like that extra cognitive exertion of turning that into a checklist can sometimes actually be an obstacle. And I do this with my patients when we do like executive dysfunction work. It really is like, how can you put that into something that feels very direct and very doable? The example I will sometimes give my patients is when I was writing my dissertation, it was so overwhelming. It was such a mountain to climb that I had to break things down so small that sometimes like the first thing on my to-do list was like, open your dissertation, open chapter 8 of your diss, because that felt like I couldn't even get it open on my computer. So I'm only kind of giving this out to people who might feel similarly, because I really do work with a lot of patients who express something like this. It can be really helpful for me when I think of the thing to do to almost outsource that. I write it down, then it serves as a cue, and there's something about it that actually really does motivate me.
That is so helpful, because now I'm realizing that we were talking about two slightly different things or slightly different worries. And I think I might have a synthesis.
Okay, I'm excited.
What I was thinking was that the reason why something like come up with a reply to the Alapin or something like that as a directive would be off-putting is because that is actually such an involved and monumentous task.
Oh, yeah. My brain had already gone here, but you beat me to the punch, so go for it.
Yeah. Maybe that could be useful in the sense of when a year from now and you have more time, or if you wake up one day randomly with a lot of motivation, the fact that you have some rather monumentous tasks written down, that could be a great use of that random day or that time in the far future. But if we're talking about something that's actionable when time is scarce, or maybe even motivation is scarce too, something like learn a response to the Alapin is not there, but something far more small scope, like find a consistent third move in Alapin, or and this is almost the equivalent of open the Word document is, okay, if you find yourself against 2C3, you don't know anything, look in the database for 30 seconds, see what scores well, see what might make sense. This all might be revised later, but can you pick a fucking second move and stick with it? And then, you know, 2 weeks later, maybe pick a third move and stick with it shows up. And you might end up with something vaguely resembling an Alapin repertoire in a year without ever having developed an entire repertoire for the Alapin on your checklist, nor would you have responded to that. But also, even if that doesn't happen, just something like learn the next move. And this is something that Nate Solomon talked about when we talked about openings when he was a guest a while ago.
I literally was thinking of that exact conversation while you were talking.
Because what he would add to it is if you have a sort of STEM opening repertoire file, something like a Lee Chess study, it could really just start with Alapin. Okay, against E4, I play C5. When they go to C3, ? Then next step would be, all right, what's your move? All right, I'll play the knight F6. Wouldn't recommend, by the way. Okay, when they go 3E5, ? Turns out maybe you put your knight on a random square, learn third move, check third move on that really microscopic checklist. Hey, there's only one good one. That's good to know. Now I know. And you're actually not only checking things off on this checklist by doing these little tasks like learning one new move in the opening, but you're also documenting it in something like a study. And I think that if you're doing it like this, where you're taking the 10 seconds after a game and saying, that went terribly, where did I stop knowing what I was doing? Can I find one more move in the opening there? And can I put that in my little study? Yeah, sure. So he would definitely be pro adding it to the study. But I'll say even without that piece, just having a sort of mental checklist, if we're talking about the really early stages of, can I go one move deeper, or can I learn some vague outline of an idea of how to play, could be really useful in this very small scope way.
Yeah. Okay. You covered a lot. And I think that's all great. That's exactly what I was thinking. Because when I said Alapin, I kind of meant that as a shorthand. But the thing I really would be writing down in line with kind of what I was saying about really chunking in terms of those tasks would be, oh, this reminds me of that, I don't know, Gotham Chess video that I've seen about the Alapin that I've always meant to watch. So I'm going to write down, like, go watch that. Like, it's good to be super directive. At least for me, I find it super helpful. And I also 1000% thought of Nate's advice, which is such good advice, which is just create a study with the various openings that you play, throw those games in there, and just go one move deeper. I thought that was just really, really brilliant.
Yeah. Because for anybody who's tried to do a lot of batch memorization, you'll find A, it's hard, B, it's hard to retain, C, it's hard to understand the ideas behind what you retain, and D, it's really easy to mix up the variations and whatnot. But if you've gotten 8 moves deep in a line, and then you get your shit rocked in 11 moves, and then you spend 5 minutes really trying to figure out why the 9th move you played was bad, and you find a better one, and you put it in your study, and you write a sentence explaining the idea, you're actually going to remember that. And that might be the only opening study you do that day or that week, but you're going to remember it. And if that's just one of 30 variations you cram in a sitting, you might remember the 9th move, and you might not, but you certainly won't remember the ideas as well.
Right. Beautiful.
And that ties me in to, speaking of batch memorization and cramming, I said I wanted to start with what's so bad about a book. But the other answer to what resources are there for tactics that aren't sitting down with the book that are better than some of the algorithmically generated puzzle generators is tactics courses on Chessable.
Yeah, good point. Forgot about this.
I think that some of the tactics courses that are on Chessable, I think that's some of the better content on the site. I think that...
Absolutely. I fully agree.
I think that I'm not as convinced as some people are about things like woodpecker method, or that the idea that you need to be doing spaced repetition on your tactics and doing them over and over until you can do an entire chunk in a day or something like that. I don't necessarily mean that that's valuable, but what I mean is at the very least, you're getting a compilation of tactics that have been curated with explanations in words that are spelled out and that are maybe divided by theme or give you something or might tell you what variation there is. And I think that's nice, because if you can do that on your phone or laptop or something, then that's probably a much more beneficial, interactive, just pedagogically sound way of approaching tactics. And like the new in chess series for 1,001 exercises they have for beginners, for club players and advanced club players. That whole series is great. The beginners is challenging. Like I'd say it's for people with 4-digit ratings for sure, which isn't what most people would say is beginners. And club players is really great for C, B, maybe A players, and advanced club players is probably for A players and experts. But this is 1,000 puzzles or so each for this 3-part series. And so for whatever the price of a chessable course is, probably not that much more than the price of a book. That's a lot of puzzles. And you get it, you know, in app form. And you can still maybe try to add whatever sorts of tracking you can do for that. But at the very least, you can see the tracking on the site for what you have or haven't done. And that can be useful too.
Yeah. And maybe we can, Jade, in the show notes, just put a couple examples of those types of chessable courses.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think people would be really interested to kind of get that recommendation from someone like you who works with a lot of people across those levels that you know is kind of tried and true.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I think that where this sometimes runs into problems for people is people who feel like their chessable queue is something that has to be zeroed out will struggle with solving these puzzles, and then the puzzles come up for review and they don't want to spend the hours it will take to review the hundreds of puzzles they've already done.
And you can tweak that setting, no?
You can. And I think there's ways to tweak, there's ways to pause, there's ways to play around. But also the way I think of my chessable queue is I don't care about what the total number of things for review are. I'll pay attention only to the reviews by a specific courses. So for instance, right now, I am actually trying to learn a new opening response to D4, C4 that isn't the Benoni. So when those lines...
Good luck.
Thank you. It's the Benoni.
The good one.
But just to say, so when things come up for review in that course, I'll review them because I'm actually trying to learn, and space repetition, et cetera, can be useful for openings. And then I'll also do tactics on Chessable from courses that I've purchased or been gifted. And when those things come up for review, I almost never do them because I don't care. Maybe sometimes I will, but that's just not really what I'm trying to do. So that means my queue overall will have thousands of moves in it or whatever. But my queue for the opening that I'm currently learning, I'll try to zero out every day.
Yeah, I like that idea. I just like the idea of Chessable, because that was sort of my other question is like, what alternatives are there to just, you know, Chesscom app puzzles? What could actually feel like I'm building again, like the upward spiral, getting that momentum? That's a really nice answer.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, I think, my main other answer. So all of this was just coming out of the initial conversation we were having about moments where you don't feel particularly motivated, and the ways that puzzles, from puzzle rushy things to puzzle apps to books to Chessable courses, can jump in there, and ways that tracking our progress on those things and on some of the games we play, even the games we play when we're not super focused, can give us so much small scope direction of where to go or what we can do in a way that can really build some of that momentum.
Beautiful.
How does that all sound?
Yeah, I feel like I have a nice list of things. I feel like I was able to pick out some stuff that I genuinely feel like I would and could use. There were even like more ideas that I kind of had, like as you were talking, you would make me think of something and it wasn't exactly the what you were suggesting, but was parallel.
Amazing.
And I really feel like I could start with those. Yeah.
Would you like to share with the group what any of those ideas you had were?
Pass. I just started thinking, like, how does that function? Why is that helpful? I do think it helps with the momentum. And I do think it helps with something that I was getting at, not in words, but this idea of really slowing down. If I want to be improving at chess and not just vomiting out hyperbolic games, I have to find ways to get myself to, at the end of the day, think more deeply. And there's like a very tiny barrier of entry to that. But I think it's a good point because there's enough of a barrier that there's times where I just don't do it. But if I can remind myself that the barrier is small, I think I can really get over the hump more than I have been and more than I think I will. So some of the ways I was thinking about that were just really small things. One of them was even like, I could be doing the same tactics that I do always, but when I find one that stumps me, like I'll take a screenshot and send it to you and be like,
there you go.
I do that sometimes. Like, hey, how quick did you get this? If there's one that really stumps me and then eventually I see it, for some reason this tickles me, like, oh, why didn't I see that quick? I'll send it to JJ and sort of ask, hey, how long did this take you? And then there's a response in like less than 10 seconds and it, I don't know, it's just another way of fueling my own excitement and investment, just things that give me that reward response. Maybe that's even kind of what it boils down to, like what keeps me going. So there were other ones that I thought of too when we were sort of talking about, let's do some tracking. And for me, it might be when I think of an idea of something that feels even slightly exciting about my own study, but I don't have the time or the energy for it now, I could start having a running list. Like, oh yeah, this was the thing that felt exciting. Maybe I do want to watch that YouTube video on this type of opening. And one that I thought of while we were talking today was the type of chess puzzle that's not just these really differentiating lines where the second best line is, you know, a full 2 or 3 points worse at least, but that really get at these more slight minutiae. Well, I certainly don't have the time or the capacity for it now, but I have been high up on my list. I've been wanting to reevaluate like a grandmaster from our favorite sack of shit. And Eugene, which is just to say, like, so for me, that would be like a running short list. Okay, put that on my list. So then the next time I'm thinking, oh, I should crack open a book. I could even just read a few pages. I really feel like just finding these ways to chip away would benefit me.
Yes, that's such a great example of something that could go on that list. And what you said is spot on, because where if you find yourself with that motivation in that moment, not knowing where to go or where to channel that energy into is such a great motivation killer. Or if not motivation killer, what will happen for me is if I feel excited about chess, but don't have that running list of things to do or things I've been meaning to do, then maybe I turn that into playing bullet for hours. And if I instead had a list that I could turn to with things that at some point or another excited me, and I just did those things with that motivation, that would be great. But if I instead try to figure out what's exciting to me without that list, or even if I try to build that list, which is its own, building a list organically every time something comes into your head, easy. Building that list because it's, quote, list building time, and you don't want to just play random bullet, and you have motivation, and then you spend an hour putting together a list of every video you think you should watch and everything that you think you want to do. Usually, I'm pretty tired and don't feel like doing anything after I do that. So having that already there and not sapping your motivation by building that list or by trying to circumvent the list, I think is really valuable.
That's exactly what I was getting at. Well said.
And if you find you, the listener, if you find puzzles as you do this that stump you, you can tweet at ChessFeelsPod and share them with us. And we can tell you how long it took us to solve them and roast you. And then you can guess which one of us responded.
I will not roast you. I will tell you a time that's a full minute slower than your time and you'll feel good.
I'll roast you.
Brilliant. Anything else, JJ, that you can think of that you would be thinking about asking, doing with someone kind of coming in for the first time?
To be honest, in a real lesson or consultation or conversation for the first time, definitely not, because I'm not trying to overwhelm. And we've already covered so much and so much has come up organically that I would very much be like, okay, you have some ideas, go off and do them and tell me how they go and let's follow up from there. And I'm tempted to say that maybe what we should do is not add to this right now, but I would love to follow up in a few weeks and hear if you were if you were able to do any of this, or you know, what did or didn't feel possible. I'm not expecting you to, you know, have checked a lot of things off of this list, but I'll be curious whether even building such a list ended up feeling easy, or if it felt difficult, or if it felt motivating to do it or not. I'd be very curious to hear about that and pick up and see what we add to our discussion in the future. That's definitely how I would handle this in a lesson.
Cool. Yeah, sounds good to me.
Yeah. Are there other things you want to talk about? Because, I mean, we could.
I don't know what the things are to talk about. That's your job.
Okay. Well, you really need a good reply to the Alapin.
I know the best reply to the Alapin. I do play D5. What move? What move order? You know, you just wing it, but...
1D5, the anti-Alapin.
Actually, that is a great anti-Alapin.
This is, I don't think I've said this on the pod once, but you know how move orders that are meant to avoid certain openings will be called like the anti-such and suches? So playing not knight F3 and D4 is an anti-Sicilian after E4, C5. So I'm going to start calling playing D4, knight F6, C4, C5, 3, D5 as white, playing into the Benoni. I'm going to start calling that the anti-Benoni.
Calling it that to whom? Like, where do you... Okay.
Myself.
Just every time you see it, ah, yes, the anti-Benoni.
I mean, I genuinely will say that.
That's the customization I want on Lee Chess. When someone plays E4, I want like the little label that shows up to be the anti-Benoni.
Yeah. Yeah. The ECO code. It's binary.
All right. Well, thanks for the help, JJ. I'll let you know.
Don't thank me yet. I want to hear how it goes.
All right.
Yeah.